All right. I'll call this meeting to order. Because nobody else is. All right, and the first bill before us, House File 3139, Representative Bigum. Does anybody move this bill?
Sure, I will.
I will.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 3139. Where's it going? To the General Register. All right, Representative Bigum, to your bill.
Thank you. And this has nothing to do with inflatable amusement rides or driving or anything. So this is a real technical, clean-cut bill. So I appreciate Representative Hillstrom moving it, and I appreciate the committee hearing the bill. House File 3139 is a technical bill from a wonderful piece of legislation that was very bipartisan and overwhelmingly supported by the chief. The chief author was Representative Hillstrom for the Vulnerable Adults Act. And so this is just a technical bill, and I will turn it over to Nancy Haas from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and my co-worker Dave Brown from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nancy Haas with Messerly & Kramer, here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And this is one of two of our association's proactive bills this year. As Representative Bigum discussed, this was a bill that was carried last year that was supported by about 50 organizations, our organization one of them. The reason for this bill today is because through the process last year, the bill, Section 4 of the bill, was added to allow subpoena power for county attorneys under the ability to have subpoena powers of banking and financial records of a vulnerable adult. And in the course of the Senate hearings, they thought that maybe they would fine-tune the language and take out the existing language in line 3, which is our addition that allows for governments to be able to access financial records under a judicial or administrative subpoena. And so they added the language down below for financial or for vulnerable adults, but took out the more general language related to any time a government would seek financial records disclosed in response to a judicial or administrative subpoena. And so our goal with this bill is just to put the language back in the form that it was before the bill last year. This language we feel is important because there are other circumstances that arise for law enforcement to obtain judicial and administrative subpoenas. Some examples include closed account checks, bad checks, access to bank records, account numbers, and safety deposit boxes for proof. And so it is very technical in terms of just reinstating the language that was mistakenly omitted last year. And we would be happy to stand for any questions.
Any discussion on this bill? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against this bill? All right. Seeing no further discussion. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 3139 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. And the motion carries.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Paymar. We've got some time constraints this morning, and so we're going to allow 25 minutes for this bill, and that will be 5 minutes for those for or against to present testimony, and 15 minutes for questions and discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Still says Representative Smith is the chief author, but I'm assuming that's all. In your packet, it's all okay. I would move, Madam Chair, even though my name's not on it, House File 1396, and the motion would be that it would be passed and referred to Public Safety Policy.
All right, Representative Paymar, to your bill.
Madam Chair, this is a fairly simple amendment, but a bill, and it is just providing an additional relief when someone is obtaining a civil order for protection, as you know, members, the judge can order a number of different reliefs, excluding the respondent from going to the petitioner's residence, excluding the respondent from going to the place of employment, ordering counseling, child support, et cetera, in order to keep that victim safe. Civil order for protections are very important. And one of the items that a lot of states have recognized, and Minnesota should recognize by adopting this language, is to offer an additional relief that deals with the issue of pets in the household. This is not a frivolous matter, members. I am speaking to you. I have people from the Humane Society as well as from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women and deputy sheriff from Scott County to testify. But I'd just like to say to you that I'm speaking to you not just as a legislator, but someone who's worked in this field for 30 years. And I know what batterers will do to victims in order to either get them to drop the charges, to not seek an order for protection, to stay within an abusive relationship. And the most vulnerable areas for a battered woman in one of these situations is the thought of losing their children and losing their pets, or hearing the threat from a batterer that they're going to kill or harm a child or a pet. And believe me, it happens. I worked with a family where the husband said to the woman, "I want you to go out to the garage. I want to see what I left for you." She went out there, and he had killed the two of her puppies with a hammer and smashed them to death in the garage. You've heard these cases, not just in the metropolitan area, but all through the state, where a batterer has thrown a dog or a puppy against a wall or thrown an animal off a porch. You know, it's not just out of anger that they're doing this. They're trying to reach deep into that battered woman's psyche and saying, if you don't stay, if you don't stop what you're doing, this is what's going to happen to you, or this is what's going to happen to the kids or the pets. So this offers the judge an additional relief that deals specifically with companion animals or pets that would maintain possession of that pet with the petitioner in the order. So that's what the bill does. I'd like my testifiers to talk, and then I would also like to speak at the end, members, about a letter that you received from the NRA, which I find deeply troubling, and I'd like to explain that. But first, Deputy Sheriff.
My name is Sarah Gorman. I'm representing the Scott County Sheriff's Office. First of all, we'd like to convey that law enforcement strongly supports this amendment. The question of battered women's and battered family safety should not rely on the status and safety of their household pets. We want to also be clear in some questions that we received, we are not here on an animal rights platform. We are here on a human and domestic violence prevention platform. One of the most dangerous times in a violent relationship is just before or just after leaving the abuse, and this applies to the pets as well. Several studies have shown that as many as 71% of women who have fled violent relationships report actual or threatened violence to their pets. 54% report actual violence or death of the animal. 60% report worry for their pets as affecting their decision to leave the relationship. And these are people who have already decided to leave. So we're already talking about a very, very small number of people that have decided to leave the relationship. And now 60% of that small number are delaying as many as 2 months from leaving that relationship because of their pets. By specifically protecting animals through civil proceedings such as OFPs, we are preventing future acts of domestic violence and allowing for the recovery process to begin. By treating domestic violence as a whole house problem, we can prevent needless brutality and prevent the perpetual cycle of fear, victimization, and brutality.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Dan Nijalik. I represent Minneapolis Animal Care and Control, and I just want to echo the words of the Deputy Sheriff in regards to the importance of this issue. People in domestic violence situations are not leaving situations because of fear of what's going to happen to their pet. And as we look at violence in our communities, we really need to make sure we're doing everything we can to support people who are in violent situations in their homes and supporting them in getting out. The City of Minneapolis, I'm proud to announce, just recently authorized Minneapolis Animal Care and Control and the Minneapolis Police Department to start a new initiative, a domestic violence intervention initiative, where we will provide up to 5 no-cost days of kenneling for pets, for individuals trying to leave a domestic violence situation and have no place for their animals to go. This bill would support and allow us to do our job more effectively in regards to an order for protection would clearly delineate that who the pet belongs to and support us in this initiative. Clearly, by doing this, we're going to give people the opportunity to get out of a violent situation and hopefully move on and deal with, you know, kids in that, moving on for that situation. But it's something we've seen over the course of the year. This picture of a puppy is just another example of the stories that we hear about where we were called out last year. The Minneapolis Police Department was called out for a domestic situation. We were then called out in the course of the altercation. A puppy was choked and thrown to the ground and subsequently died from his injuries. A tragedy for the animal, but what's the emotional toll on the victim in that situation? It's real. It's something that's really important. It seems small, but the impact, I believe, will once again help us to deal with some of the violence in our communities. Thank you.
I'm Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We're a member organization, have member programs located throughout the entire state. And I'm just here to say that our coalition and our member programs are in support of the bill, and I'm here to sit for questions.
We're going to have testimony first and then take questions at the end. So is there anyone here who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Okay, great. Well, then we can go right to questions.
Okay.
Oh, Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, just so I'm understanding, this would establish the pet as with the same protections that the persons or children have under the order, and how are they going to go about delineating whose pet it is? If it's a hunting dog, that's typically probably the dads or the males in the household, and not ours. But I mean, what's that process going to involve?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, it would be, as you know, as a lawyer, that when both parties go to, I get a little companion music here as we, as you know, and when someone's filing for an order, the petitioner will fill out an affidavit, and there'll be a number of different check boxes that the petitioner is seeking. Mm-hmm. If the petitioner is seeking possession of the pet, then they would check that if the pet was, you know, primarily hers or his, depending on who was seeking the order. It would ultimately be up to the judge to make that decision. Ms. Richards, do you want to, because you know, Ms. Richards from the coalition might have an idea from other states how they've done this.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
And members of the committee, a number of states already have these type of provisions already in place, and we provided some written testimony. A list of those states is at the bottom of that written sheet the committee members have. Excuse me. The other thing is we already know that in the state of Minnesota, there are some judges who have issued orders that do include pets on them under the provisions of other safety. Provisions can be ordered in these. The difference really is, and it doesn't appear to have been a problem in terms of trying to figure out possession of the pets when it has come up in hearings. The reason why it's important to put it into the bill is what we've heard is that for those people who come in pro se, without attorneys, without advocate information, oftentimes are unaware and aren't equipped to sort of argue to the court about relief for their pets. And we've heard from across the state that battered women are staying because they don't believe they have any way to seek relief. And so this is putting it specifically into the bill. We don't believe, there hasn't been any problems in other states that we know of in terms of this, the question that you're raising, and it hasn't been an issue here when it has come up.
Madam Chair, go ahead, Representative.
The Deputy Sheriff would like to just make a comment on this also.
Okay.
One additional failsafe that's already built into the OFP law to cover those kind of questions is that when an OFP is applied for and granted, it's on a temporary basis. So the temporary transfer of that animal and the question of who owns it, is it a hunting dog or has there actually been violence, is on a 7-day basis. And at that point, then a hearing can be held and proof can either be brought that no abuse has been happening to that animal and thus that animal doesn't need to be covered, or the actual owner can show, this is my dog, this is a hunting dog, the abused victim has never had contact, has never cared for the dog, and there's no reason for the animal to be included in the bill, and a determination can be made at that.
Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Pimar, and to the witness from the Sheriff's Office. So let me understand the two thoughts are going through my head, or two questions. First of all, what is there a possibility or a potential here that a reverse spite situation could be created in that, oh, now I can threaten that I'm going to take his pet away and it's his hunting dog. And you know, we also hear about situations where one side feels that the other side's getting all kinds of free advocates and free attorneys and they're having to pay for it. And so any thought gone into a reverse situation where it's just thrown in because they can and then they know they aren't going to get it, but it's a way to just create some spite on the other side. The second thing is does it have to be that there's been threat or abuse, or can they just protect the pet because somebody wants to have it protected?
Well, Madam Chair, I'll address your second question first, that what happens with any of the relief underneath the order for protection, that people request that relief in their petition, and that it's up to the judicial discretion to determine which relief is appropriate. There isn't a specific requirement that the pet have an act of violence against them. They aren't being treated as if they were a petitioner. I mean, this is a relief much the same as you can ask for temporary custody of your children under this order. You can ask for exclusions around your homestead. You can ask for, you know, a whole variety. I believe there's 15 types of relief available under the order for protection. And these processes are set up for people to be pro se. Judges are used to taking information from parties in a pro se fashion into determining what relief is appropriate. Because somebody hasn't directly injured the pet doesn't mean that threat isn't underlying, or there might not be some other reason in which a party may seek relief and it may not be appropriate for the court to give control of the family pet to the petitioner. Respondents always have the ability to argue for that relief not to be issued under the order. And if they make solid arguments to the court as to why it's inappropriate, that's taken into account and is part of the decision about whether the relief is granted or not.
Representative Jaskowski.
Madam Chair, the first part of my question hasn't been answered.
Representative,
would you restate that, please?
Well, basically, what preventions or fail safes are in here to not have this be added in just as a way to spite the other side? As you know, Representative Pimar, that does go on, and I don't want to add more fuel to a fire that oftentimes is a volatile, anyways.
Madam Chair,
Representative Westrom,
you know, I'm not saying that could never happen, but as Ms. Richards says, there are 13 or 14 other reliefs. I mean, so checking the box for a lot of those reliefs could add spite or conflict in obtaining an order for protection. Does that happen? I think so, but in very few cases. Most victims who seek orders for protection are fearful for themselves, for their children. They may not want to end the relationship forever, but they need a temporary separation, and they seek that order. Sometimes they go to counseling and they reestablish their relationship. Sometimes they don't. That's what the civil order for protection was, to give some temporary time, the marriage where there's been violence or the threat of violence, a temporary respite to sort things out. And, you know, it's a complicated thing, just like a marriage and a divorce. So I can't say that unequivocally that, you know, that would never happen, but I would think it would be minuscule. And as Ms. Richards said, the judge would have the ultimate determination. So if the respondent at the hearing said, you know, that's my hunting dog, what are you talking about? You know, I'm sure the judge would listen to that and take that into account. So I think this is, I can't tell you, Representative Westrom, how many situations where a victim literally does not leave in an abusive relationship when she should have, because she's afraid of that pet. And I don't know if you have pets. I've had dogs and cats. I know how attached I get to them. They're like my kids. And, you know, it's not easy it's not easy when you know that that person is capable of doing what they say they're going to do. And so I guess I would leave it at that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Paymar and the testifiers, I wonder about this. The first question would be, I'm curious as to whether the Humane Society of the United States and PETA support this bill. And I guess I would ask that as the first question.
I know that... Madam Chair, I think the Humane Society, Mr. Goldman is here from the Humane Society. I have no idea what PETA's position is. They don't consult me. Neither does the NRA, believe it or not.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Paymar. So that does bolster my sense that this there is certainly some animal rights support behind this bill. I heard from the law enforcement representative here that I heard a term there that was kind of alarming to me, and it talked about a whole house problem. We're kind of at the point where we're putting animals in a position of being equated to people here, and that's troubling to me. You know, when we're talking about a whole house problem, and you know, you're talking about people and animals, so that's I'm curious as to what you meant by that. That would be my question,
Madam Chair. Representative, the whole house concept is finally in the realm of domestic violence and taking a proactive approach against it. In the past, it's only been the battered person that is part of the victim, that has part of the violence or has suffered from it. And clearly we show, and studies have shown, that children who may not be the direct response or receiving the direct abuse from the abuser are victims of the violence that are going on in the home. The effect that the abuse on animals, and we're not trying to equate them as equally as humans, the effect on animals, the abuse on animals has an effect on the people in the home. Much like Representative Paymar was saying, is see what I did to this dog, I can do it to you. And you're showing the children the violence that it's in the home, and the children sometimes end up repeating it, and we continue the cycle of violence. If it's the children, if the cycle even goes down, is that the batterer abuses one parent who then abuses the children who then abuses the animal. If we can break that somewhere, that would be a wonderful start in treating it as a whole home problem.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski, one more question.
Thank you. So then, why wouldn't we extend that to other property? Why wouldn't we extend that to cars and sentimental belongings? I think we're on a slippery slope here where we're putting these pieces into this restraining order, into these protective orders, which on an ex parte basis, I understand, are granted nearly 100% of the time. And, of course, we know in an ex parte hearing, there is no hearing. The individual basically alleges domestic violence, and it's granted for 7 days, I believe, is what it is. And then that ex parte order largely colors the longer-term order, too. So I find those problematic, and I guess I would just really have comments there rather than a question, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A comment as well. I worked in adult and juvenile probation for 30-plus years. Now, this issue that you're raising, Representative Paymar and the folks are testifying, is a real issue. I work with these gentlemen who have strangled cats and dogs and thrown them against the walls and that sort of thing. And it has been in a specific domestic situation. That's what's going on. It's about intimidation. It's about fear. It is a serious issue, and I think it is a very reasonable addition to relief that the court has the discretion to provide. You know, it might not be in all cases, but boy, I've sure seen the practical effect of offenders in situations where they use these pets specifically to intimidate the woman they're living with. It's a big issue and a serious issue and needs to be addressed, and I think this does it.
Madam Chair, if I can just close with
One more question. Oh, Representative Scott, and then I'd like you to close and address that NRA letter.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, aren't there already laws on the books for protection of animals and cruelty to animals? Isn't that already against the law to torture or kill an animal?
Yes, there are, and I believe, and they are enforced. The question here is, if you're in an abusive situation and you're seeking separation through an order for protection, the question is if the respondent, the batterer, or the respondent, I should say, has made threats to either harm the pet or harm the children, you'd want to be able to go in with that petition and say, I want the separation from my abusive spouse, and I want possession of the pet during that time so I don't have to worry that that animal is going to be harmed. I mean, that's the issue. And so if someone is afraid to go in and get that order because they think that the abuser is going to maintain control of the pet, they won't go. They'll stay in that abusive situation. I know that Representative Joskowski talks about the trying to separate the difference between animals and children, and I would agree, but that's not how emotionally people feel about their pets. And so why would we want to keep a woman or a man in an abusive situation because of those fears? This is just an additional relief that the court has, and it's really you'd be doing the right thing by passing this bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess if it were me in that situation, I don't know who doesn't know that cruelty to animals is against the law. And I guess I just don't see the connection that you're making there. I would, if it were me in that situation, I'd take my dog with me anyway. I mean, make arrangements, because I would know already that dog may be in danger, and that if that person, the batterer, approaches myself or the dog, it's against the law to batter me, and it's against the law to be cruel to the animal. So I guess I don't see the necessity of this. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do, but I don't see the connection because I think it's already in law.
You want to crack it?
Madam Chair, I can address the question. Representative, I mean, first I would say, one, I think that's an indication that probably you weren't being battered. Is the first thing I would say is that that having the ability to say I would take the dog, I would go ahead and be assertive about that means that you don't have somebody who is willing to on the other side go to some fairly extreme lengths to threaten and harm your pet, to do things about that pet. But and the distinction between the animal cruelty laws and what this is doing is the animal cruelty law waits until there's an action against the pet. right? That's going to trigger the law. What this says is that if you're in fear for the safety of your animal, and that it can then be pulled into the protective order, that it takes, it gives the ability, excuse me, it also says that one of the things under the order for protection, it says that you can remain within your home and not have to take and flee someplace. And if you have a pet and you don't have any place to flee, and one of the things we know that happens in battering situations is isolation. So if you have no place to go with your pet, you're left staying in your house with having to, and that's one of the things the protective order does, is it allows you to exclude the abuser from your homestead on a temporary basis. It also means that you could also protect the animal that is there in the home with you as well, and not have to wait for some sort of act, criminal act against the animal, to take some sort of action.
Representative Paymark, could you wrap up? We're already 5 minutes over.
Representative Scott, I'd be happy to talk with you about this further. I know it's sort of a, and I understand you still have questions, but I do want to address the NRA letter before I get cut off here. Members, I usually don't come to the committees thinking I'm going to lose. Usually I like to know I have the votes or I can somehow persuade committee members. And this letter from the NRA is deeply troubling to me, and I may indeed lose this vote today because of it. But I'm going forward with the bill because it's the right thing to do. And I just want to say, if you really believe that this letter from the NRA, if you really believe that this bill tramples on Second Amendment rights, this is beyond the pale. I mean, we all get letters from special interests that we care about, whether it's the chamber or labor, and we always look and we say, okay, well, maybe we should stick with it. But this one is just beyond, the twist logic in this is just beyond belief. I want to just quickly quote this. It says, it talks about what happens, because if you do violate an order for protection, you could lose your ability to carry a firearm. That's a good thing. We don't want batterers to have firearms because that's one of the most dangerous factors for them to commit a homicide. So that is in law. That's federal law. It's the Lautenberg Amendment. But here's what it says. This is what the NRA says. Any number of relatively innocent scenarios could easily be imagined for such contact. The respondent, meaning the batterer, could see the family pet wandering the street and return it to its enclosure. He or she could see the animal tied up outside on a hot day and provide it with water. The animal itself could even seek out the respondent, as pets have been known to do. Well, my question is, if there's an order for protection that says that the respondent cannot go near the petitioner's household, what are they doing outside where the animal could seek out the respondent? What are they doing outside seeing that the animal's tied up? What are they doing in the neighborhood? You could stretch that same logic and look to another relief in the order that says that the respondent's not supposed to go to the place of business of the petitioner. According to the NRA, stumbled into a mall where the petitioner was working, you'd be in violation of the order. What if you went into City Hall or the government complex here where the petitioner was working, you would be in violation of the order. There are, you know, so relatively innocent scenarios? I don't think so. So, listen, I, you know, vote it down. If you think that this NRA letter makes sense, then vote it down. If you really believe there's any infringement on Second Amendment rights, vote it down. But if you believe in trying to protect safety of victims of domestic violence, I'd ask you to support the bill.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And as to your answer, Mr. Paymar, what I really think is, in 32 years as a prosecutor, I never had one of these instances. I don't know if this is that earth-shaking matter that justifies being on the books of the law.
All right. We are already almost 10 minutes over time. I'm not going to allow any further discussion.
Madam Chair, I ask for a roll call.
All right. Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 1396 be passed and referred to public safety policy. All those... the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Champion.
Aye. Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kelly. Representative Kulik Jackson.
Aye.
Representative Mahoney. Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Westrum.
No.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
The ayes being 6 and the nays 5, the motion carries.
Thank you, members.
All right, the next bill for consideration is House File 2996. Representative Mullery, would you like to move your bill and indicate where you'd like it to go?
Madam Chair, with the amendment we intend to do, it can go directly to the General Register.
All right, then, Representative.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shouldn't this go to Commerce?
I don't believe it goes to Commerce. They didn't ask for it. It would have gone to Representative Hillstrom's committee from here, but that we're taking out the criminal penalties.
Representative Scott.
Yes, this seems to relate to business, so I would think that it would need to go to Commerce.
Apparently, Commerce never asked for the bill, Representative Mullery?
No. And it's basically, a legal proceedings in the courts, so it belongs in this committee.
All right, then, Representative Mullery moves House File 2996. To be referred to the General Register. Representative Mullery, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Most people haven't heard of this, what it's called on the East Coast is a new scourge. But it's starting to appear here, and the Attorney General has already had to take some actions on trying to look into this issue. It's called debt buyers. And there's enormous companies that are, it's a multi-billion dollar business now nationally. And they're companies that buy debts for anything from half cent to 7 cents on the dollar. There's national studies, including by the Federal Government Accounting Office, that show a lot of unscrupulous collection tactics from unsuspecting targets. And unlike your local bank collectors who have a reason to keep you from spreading a lot of negative statements or anything about the bank, these debt buyers have no concern about a good image. And studies show they are engaged in fraud, misrepresentation, and totally reckless disregard of the rights of their targets. They take debts that they know they can't legally collect, such as ones discharged in bankruptcy or which are far beyond the statute of limitations and are not subject to lawsuits. They trick people into making a payment which suddenly gives them the right to sue for collection of the former debt. They send out collection letters and lawsuits over and over and hope people will default. Often people won't respond because they know they don't owe it. In fact, often they weren't even the subjects of the claimed debt. They are known to often just look for someone by the same name in the same region, then sue that person without even verifying it's the same person. In many cases, there's no documentation of why the debt is owed or why charges and fees were added or credit for payments. Often, there's no proof whatsoever that the debt is owed. The Federal Trade Commission has recommended conducting reasonable investigations. The U.S. Court of Appeals has suggested requiring detailed files of the alleged debt. The General Accounting Office says debt buyers do very little to verify debts. The Federal Trade Commission recommended that they notify consumers of the right to require suspension of collection until verified, and that info about the original creditor and debt be supplied, and that there be an itemization of principal, interest, and fee computations. The FTC also found consumers often weren't properly served with a lawsuit, and with weak evidence of the debt were having default judgments against them. The FTC found inadequate info about the debt, and that debt buyers would often tell consumers that they were legally obligated to pay the debt, and that they could be arrested and properly seized. The FTC also found that debt buyers who sent credit cards to consumers with charged-off debt, telling them the old debt would be reported as paid in full to credit agencies, then the consumers had to pay 25 to 50% promptly after that. So what this bill requires is a 30-day notice before starting a lawsuit, which requires proof of ownership, original debt info, and an accounting, plus a notice that the debt may be barred by passage of time. Bars starting suits until investigating reasons the debtor gave to dispute the debt. It requires an affidavit from the seller regarding info so they can be punished if there's a false information. It requires an attorney to determine statute of limitations that didn't bar recovery. It prevents the revival of discharged or time-barred debt because there's so much misrepresentation involved with these groups. They need to file the info on the debt in court, and it allows the wrong debtor to sue to collect damages and penalties. And there's so many mistakes and fraud and misrepresentations basically in this area. We need to protect the public. So with that, Madam Chair, Mr. Slade would like to testify about direct experience.
We're going to handle the amendments first. I've got two amendments labeled A1 and A2.
Which one? A1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Elwood will explain. Yeah. He worked with Mr. Gehring would be the best to explain the affidavits since he wrote them.
Madam Chair, the A1 amendment includes some technical corrections and also moves a requirement that currently under the bill, there's a requirement that an affidavit be submitted to the debtor indicating that the statute of limitations period hasn't run, and that is being moved to a different section of the bill so that you the person looking to sue wouldn't be required to include an affidavit with that information, but rather it's just prohibiting a person from filing a suit if the statute of limitations period has run consistent with current law.
All right. And the A2?
And I'm sure the A2 amendment deletes the criminal penalty that's included at the end of the bill.
All right. Representative Mullery, will you move the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, so moved.
All right. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of Amendment A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. And the motion is carried. And are you moving the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, so moved.
All right. Any discussion to this amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of Representative Mullery's Amendment A2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And that motion carries as well. All right. And to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Slade would testify.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Nicholas Slade, and I am a consumer rights attorney in private practice. I, along with my partner, do a fair amount of work dealing with debt collection and debt collectors. My partner's actually, Pete Berry, actually specializes, and that's the only thing he does is deal with abusive debt collectors. This is dealing with debt collectors is a part of my practice, but I want to urge the passage of this bill in that as a part of my practice, I, on almost a daily basis, talk with various people who are being either sued or by debt collectors attempting to collect these old debts, or more often what happens is somebody will contact me because they're being garnished for a judgment that they may not know anything about. And in fact, yesterday I was contacted by a woman from Elk River who had just been garnished for a judgment which she knew nothing about, and when she went to the court and got the affidavit of service, turns out that the affidavit of service, that the original complaint was served on an unknown person at a completely different address that she had never lived at. So this kind of thing does arise where people know nothing about these debts and are having to defend themselves. In my practice, as I said, I'm a private defense attorney or a private attorney in doing these debt defense cases. I've found that when I do actually represent somebody, that probably in about 90% of the cases, or even more, that as soon as we put in an actual defense, the other side it will have either problems proving that they are in fact the entity that owns the debt, meaning they can't show that from the original credit card company or whatever debtor or whatever creditor there was, that it's been sold so many times that they no longer can show that they actually have really truly purchased the debt and have the right to sue on it. The other problem that happens almost in just about every case that I've ever defended is there are serious issues of proof in showing that, for one, that it's the alleged debtor's actual account, that the amounts that are correct, that there was ever a contract, and which is necessary for the debt collectors to be able to ask for attorney's fees, which are a big part of these bills, that the evidence, as soon as an attorney rears his head and starts defending these, that the claims fall apart. Now, one of the problems when people contact me, defending these cases is actually fairly expensive and it takes a bit of work. And so when these debts are for $500, well, just the filing fee alone is $320 now. And that doesn't account for my time and expense. So that very often when people call me, and as I said, I get calls every day on these things. When people call me and I start talking to them, and I tell them what it's going to cost, they can't hire me to defend these. And so even when I talk, what I end up doing more often than not is talking them through how to try and defend themselves. But it takes a fairly sophisticated person to defend themselves in these matters. And as a matter of fact, yesterday the Court of Appeals issued an opinion upholding a judgment against a party who was attempting to defend themselves pro se, trying to get at the very evidence that this law is trying to require that be put forward right up front at the time of filing, to show that somebody actually owns the debt and therefore is the right party to be suing. And that seems to me to be a very simple requirement. And again, also putting forward some of the basic underlying information that is necessary to support your claims is also, I would urge and argue, is a very simple and basic requirement. The other problem is, most of these are done through default, there's a larger problem in that the way Minnesota works its service system is court cases are commenced by service, not by actual filing. And when people get these, as Representative Mulery stated, when people get served with a summons and complaint, oftentimes they don't believe it's real. They say, well, I don't know this. This isn't me. And when they call the court because it's never been filed, the court doesn't know anything about it, and so they believe it's a fake lawsuit. And so they never respond until they're getting hit with the judgment and garnishment. And that's a very regular problem. And once it's gone to judgment, the process of undoing it is, again, very expensive, and it, while not impossible, if it's been more than a year, it gets very difficult. And so people, because of the way Minnesota has its legal system set up, oftentimes are hit with judgments that they know nothing about, or that because they never believed that it was a valid lawsuit because it wasn't their debt, they now are faced with extraordinary expenses trying to undo the process. The one other item is that oftentimes, I would just urge that this be passed. I rather than take up an enormous amount of time discussing the full debt buyer situation, I would just urge that this be passed. I think it's a very good step. It would assist the courts in just doing their minimum due diligence. Whenever they receive a default judgment, the court is supposed to, do, as a minimum, just review it to make sure that all the elements of the claim are there and have some basis. And the required information would go a long way to helping the courts do that.
Thank you, Mr. Slade. Do you have another testifier, Representative Mallory?
Very quickly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Very quickly, just want to first say that we've had some good discussion with the opponents. I think all of them, I'm not sure who's all going to come today, but I think all of them. They're very helpful in pointing out perhaps some of the mechanical issues that we would be happy to deal with. What I would like you to just keep in mind as we go forward and you hear from our opponents is let's not lose sight when potentially some of the mechanical problems are raised. Let's not lose sight of the fundamental problem here, which is we should really make sure that the plaintiffs are meeting their burden of proof, which is really all we're asking here, number one. And number two, that we're making sure that we know that the right person is being sued, the right amount is being sued for, and the statute of limitations hasn't run on the bill. Thank you very much.
Well, and for the information of the committee, the bill has been requested to go to Commerce, and so I anticipate that Representative Mallory will be amending his motion, giving even more opportunity to work on those areas. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. All right, I would appreciate brevity. Welcome to the committee, though. We've got about 10 minutes to totally wrap this up. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Heidi Stallo.
And how do you spell that last name?
S-T-A-L-O-C-H.
Please proceed, Ms. Stallo.
I'm an attorney that's been practicing in creditors' rights since 1996. There are real and perceived problems that do need to be addressed. However, the solution before you is legally unworkable and has negative unintended consequences for attorneys, consumers, debtors, creditors, and our court system. I'm not here to explain why the bill is unbalanced. That's not the issue. The bill isn't packaged yet to even be weighed to determine where that sits. There aren't mechanical issues. There are deep issues with how this bill is written and how it will play out in the practical consequences for the everyday practitioner on both sides, from the plaintiff side as well as the defendant side. Starting from the notice of intent to file a lawsuit, prior to that, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act already requires us to send a 30-day notice with some of the similar information. This notice under this bill can't be sent until that period expires. So then on day 30, we'd be also sending another notice of intent to file a lawsuit with the requisite documents attached, which are all of the assignments of that debt, the contracts, and itemized accounting from a zero balance, which surpasses the requirements of the highly regulated charge-off balance already put in place by Congress under the federal law, and includes additional notice language that is, again, similar but different to the notice that would have been sent on day one, the first 30-day notice. So a debtor on day 33, allowing a little time for mail, would be getting a packet in the mail of all of this information. To me, that seems very confusing. There has to be a better way to deliver this information that gets to the point of educating that consumer, that debtor, as to why they're being contacted. an average person receiving that packet and trying to comprehend the chain of assignments, the accounting, what is this notice really telling him or her, seems to be missing the intended target of this bill. Once that lawsuit is commenced, assuming that there's no dispute, which hasn't been resolved, many of those same documents are required to be then attached again to the summons and complaint, which will now get served under the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure. We already have rules that require service on the actual defendant. And along with that summons and complaint, you need to serve a supplementary affidavit stating the date and the amount of the last payment made by the debtor and the name and address of the person or persons to whom that payment was made. What is the purpose of this? Is it hitting the target, the intended target, or is it creating more paper to confuse a defendant? I don't know that answer. I do wish that we could have discussion from both sides of the street here to try to figure out what are we trying to achieve and what is a good way to get it to that spot and hit that mark. Subdivision 2 on line 2.30 regarding the statute of limitations. Is the intention to prevent payments or accepting long-term payment plans, hardship payments? This provision prevents a debt buyer from working with a debtor by accepting payments, or worse, forces a debt buyer who's been receiving ongoing payments from a debtor to sue because the statute's going to run. It doesn't allow time for the parties to work together and try to avoid having to enter the legal world and that expense. I don't believe that's the intention of this subdivision.
Ms. Stock, can you wrap up? We have some other testifiers and we're short of time. Thank you.
Yes. In the subdivision 3 on the default judgments, again, there are problems with line 3.1. What are these properly authenticated business records? If a debtor isn't being sued, we already have law on point. If the wrong debtor is sued, that's both ethically and statute driven to right a wrong like that. The sanctions can be interposed by a judge if deemed appropriate. So the result of this bill is confusion and a whole lot of paper. There's millions of lost filing fees, tax consequences for debtors as debt buyers will be issuing 1099s for forgiveness of indebtedness instead, increased paperwork for the courts. I think we can do better if both sides are at the table working to write a practical, balanced bill. I come here to the table to try to find something and willing to work with legal aid and the consumer bar to find something that works that serves that purpose. I urge you to allow time, giving that collaboration a chance, and to put forth a bill that's the result of thoughtful discussion, even if passionate at times, on the practical consequences of that legislation and an ability to reframe this to address the intended consequences instead of this unilateral effort. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next testifier, we'll take the testimony and then we'll have questions.
I want to thank the members of the committee for allowing us to testify today. My name is Mitchell Johnston. I'm a Minnesota attorney and also one of the oldest debt buyers in Minnesota. I've had a business since 1995. During law school, I actually volunteered on many consumer rights groups, St. Paul Tenants Credit Union. Our company takes a very consumer-friendly approach. We go looking for a win-win relationship with our debtors. We get many thank you notes. We get many people thanking us for trying to work with these people. My industry has very organized trade associations. I was called yesterday by the largest one in Washington, D.C. They wanted me to appear today and discuss some of the issues. There are several legal problems with the bill that's as proposed. We have a federal law called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which basically states that we cannot make a threat of legal action that we don't intend to follow through with. By sending something 30 days prior to say we intend to sue you, you're going to have multiple fact patterns that are going to be problematic with that provision. We might find out after we send that to the debtor that they can't pay anything for the next 3 years. They don't want a judgment against them. They want to try to work something out with us. We might find out that they're, in fact, are not worth suing because oftentimes some of these people won't call us back. We have their phone number. We'll leave multiple messages on their answering machine. And so we're going to be a follow of that rule by having this 30-day logic. I go to all 87 counties around the state. I was in court yesterday in Hennepin County. Every judge I'm going to all over the state is openly telling me that they are overburdened, under-resourced. Anything that creates an additional burden on our court system, I think, has to be weighed very carefully from a resource allocation perspective. Secondly, not allowing payments to toll the statute. There's only one state presently in the United States that has that, and it's Georgia. And from my perspective, that's the worst state in the country from a consumer's perspective, because if we buy a debt, let's say it's 3 years before statute, and the person lost a job, they're way behind financially, and they state to us, I can pay $25 a month. We might turn around and say, okay, you owe us $10,000. We'll take $5,000. No more interest. We'll cut your bill in half. We'll take $25 a month. By following this logic, at year six, they've only paid us maybe $700. We're forced to sue these people. To me, that's the worst possible outcome. For years, when I go to the courthouse, I ask the judges for a stayed judgment, which means I don't want to put a judgment on the debtor, if at all possible. It's going to hurt their ability to get an apartment. Even your veterinarian, now when you walk into a veterinarian's office, a lot of them, first thing they do is ask you for your Social Security number. They go back to the room, they run a credit bureau on you. If you don't pay your bills, they're not going to treat your animal.
Mr. Right. Johnson, can you wrap up? We have one more testifier.
The evidential issues are vague. I mean, the judges are the judges in this state are first rate. I deal with national legal issues. We have extremely good judges. Dictating to them what the evidentiary standards are for a simple contract case, I think, is just I think it's insulting, basically, to the judiciary.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Cherner. Last name is spelled C-H-E-R-N-E-R. I serve as legal counsel and director of state government affairs for ACA International, the Association of Credit and Collection Professionals that's based in Edina, Minnesota, and which represents the credit collection and debt purchasing industry. I know my time is brief, so I just want to make a few points that I think are extremely important with respect to this legislation. And it was mentioned, it was touched on before, but one of the primary purposes, it appears to be, of this legislation is to improve communication between a consumer and a debt purchaser with respect to an outstanding financial obligation. Now, communication is absolutely critical in our industry. It's the cornerstone behind successful ethical and professional collection efforts. But House File 2996 does not strike the proper balance. The debt collection, debt purchasing industry is governed by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And one of the important aspects of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is that a consumer is sent a notice informing them of the obligation and providing other information regarding the consumer's rights. All that information is usually displayed on one piece of paper. And that's important because an ordinary consumer is not going to be able to internalize a lot more information than that. They need to have basic information, amount of the debt, name of the creditor to whom the debt is owed, and the informing consumer the opportunity to verify the debt. So when we're talking about what information does a consumer want, I don't think we should just consider should it be much more information or much less information. The issue should be what is the right amount of information for a consumer to have to be able to internalize that information and then either dispute the debt, communicate with the debt purchaser to work out a payment arrangement, or to take any other action. And our concern is this legislation essentially is an info dump onto a consumer. It's for a consumer to receive on multiple occasions a substantial amount of information that they're going to have to review. And we believe an ordinary consumer will not be able to do that. So that being said, ACA is amenable to working with proponents of the bill to develop a standard of basic information that is important to the consumer, that is understandable to a consumer, and that will improve the communication between consumers and debt purchasers.
Thank you, Mr. Cherner. Our next testifier.
Thank you.
And because we are short on time, I would ask you to only hit those items that have not been discussed. Please try not to repeat anything that we've already heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to address the committee and thank you for this opportunity. I am Gary Roberts. I'm from Professional Systems. I own a company in Mankato. We have been in business, and I've been in with this company for 30 years. We're a Minnesota licensed with the Department of Commerce, and I am a debt buyer. And we service both Minnesota, and we strictly work Minnesota debts. Our job as an agency is to work with consumers, arrange payments, settle accounts, and resolve issues. A protocol we follow, whether collection for a contingent client or purchase debt, are the same. We follow the same FDCPA compliance standards that and procedures that are applied. One important difference is that as a debt buyer to consumers, we routinely settle accounts and work out settlement plans for a much less amount. So we do bring value to the consumer, and I want you to know that. These include payments of a lesser amount over a period of time, and the consumer benefits and it gets back on track. In the present form of the legislation, we feel it's unworkable, but I respectfully ask that knowledgeable credit and collection industry representatives be allowed the opportunity to provide input and participate in working the legislators with legislators and interested consumer groups to prepare a workable legislation into a form viable for both consumers and the credit industry.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Our next testifier, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm Richard Melton. I work with Mr. Johnson at Liberty Credit Services.
And I probably don't need to remind you to keep it brief.
I will keep it very brief. I'm going to say has already been said, so I won't say some of that. Again, I want to thank Madam Chairman, the committee, for hearing us. I believe that I'm a consumer advocate, both as a citizen of Minnesota and in what I do for Liberty Credit Services. I'd like to see a piece of legislation. This obviously was designed to solve a problem. I may not agree that the problem is exactly as it's described, but if there are people in our business that are doing things that sound to me like fraud, they ought to be prosecuted for fraud. If they can't prove that they own an account, that ought to be dealt with. And I won't go through the whole litany of things that are addressed in this bill. But to make it very short, I'd like to say a couple things about some of the comments made by Mr. Slade. I don't know who he sees in his practice, and I can't speak to that, but I would say this, that as a small Minnesota business, not a multi-million dollar big company, incidentally, but a Minnesota business that hires people in this economy, we're hiring people right now. We have investigators that try to find people and try to find the address, the address where they live, not John Olson in the same 20-mile area. And so the kind of frivolous and even fraudulent activity that Mr. Slade described is not what we do. And I would venture to say that a lot of Minnesota debt buyers don't do that either. Of course, there are cases that come to his attention. He's a consumer attorney. But that, I guess my point is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here, and let's not portray Minnesota debt buyers as if they're some big evil thing from the East Coast that are abusing Minnesota citizens. I don't want to repeat what Mr. Johnson described as how we deal with our consumers. We tried to set up payment arrangements for them, not small payments as the press tried to indicate, just so we could sue them of these old debts, but because we don't want to sue them. It costs us money to go to those 87 counties around the state. We don't want to sue them with judgments. But with this provision regarding the impossibility of reactivating the statute of limitations, what are we supposed to do to protect our asset and to enforce our contract? After all, when we bought this debt, we stepped into the shoes of the original creditor. It's our contract. How do we protect ourselves? And how do we protect the consumer who doesn't want to have a judgment on their record? And we don't want them to have a judgment on their record if we can work with them to that effect. I think that this legislation has good intent, excellent intent. I'm glad that it's going to another committee so we have an opportunity to work to shape this in such a way that it can satisfy everybody and we can get to sort of getting to yes.
Thank you.
And getting to a win-win situation. Thank you.
Representative Champion.
Any one of the testifiers that testified against the bill, perhaps Heidi Fatalo? Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Heidi Salo.
Okay, thank you. I might make a couple mistakes on it, but not intentional. You indicated in your testimony, and I'm going to be brief, that there are problems that need to be addressed and that you say that now's not the time by which to do that. Can you be so kind as to tell me when a person is purchasing debt, what is the documentation that is provided to those individuals from a transfer in order to evidence that, in fact, that the debt is owed and or that evidence can be used to prove up a case?
My experience, and I think some of the debt buyers that are here might be able to tell you exactly what they're getting, will be a legal assignment. So any assignment that any one of us that are attorneys that would be drafting, but a sheet of paper saying that, and then attached to that would be the itemization of what accounts are there.
that they're purchasing that are part of that particular portfolio.
Now, in your, may I have a quick follow-up?
Representative Champion, yes.
Is it in your experience also, I know it's in mine, that sometimes when a person is identified as owing a debt, has said to the person who says that they owe the debt, that I don't owe that debt. In fact, I've been paying, and here's my evidence of that. But yet and still, that's not always reflected, especially when debt is purchased by a number of people. Is that also consistent with your experience, seeing that you've been in this area for quite some time?
I think there are those cases. Those are not, they're a small percentage of the cases, in my experience, that come through, and that's something that we do listen to. I think those are definitely true stories, but not a, I would say, not an overwhelming amount of the statistically.
And would you also agree that...
Last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you also agree that when we think in terms of lawsuits, that the majority of these debts are sometimes settled before they in fact go to court, not always because the person feels they owe the debt, but because of the amount of time is so great that they have to participate in this litigation process, and perhaps what's articulated in this legislation could help all parties truly better understand what the debt is and understand what evidence can and will be put forward?
In my experience, the settlements, there are settlements that happen. It's not because they don't feel like defending it. It's because they owe the debt, and they admit that they owe that, and they understand what it is. As an attorney, I want to be able to tell them and trace that back to the original creditor. I love the ideas of some of this bill. I think how it's being packaged just it doesn't hit the mark, and it's too complicated. But yes, most people want to pay the debt and want to pay those bills, and we do settle those.
Any further questions?
And
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair, just to that point, doesn't the individual have a remedy if there is a dispute, if the debtor has a dispute whether they own that debt or not right now? Do they have a remedy?
Under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, you do. They have the ability to get the name of the original creditor and that address, along with the ability to then dispute it and request validation of that debt, and that's under the federal law.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery, would you like to amend your motion that House File 2996 be passed and referred to Commerce as amended?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery moves that House File 2996 as amended be passed and referred to Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. The next bill for consideration is House File 1182, Representative Bly.
Does somebody want to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I will.
Okay, Representative Westrom, House File 1182. And is this a Bly? Representative Bly, you have a 2199 amendment. Does Representative Westrom want to move that also?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. Is that what the author wants?
I think so, Mr. Chair. I'll let the authors. Is this my amendment, Mr. Gehring, or Representative Bly's?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, this is Representative Bly's amendment.
Okay. I'll let him speak to this. I have just a one-word amendment to clean up a piece of this bill by adding an and that was missed.
Okay. So Representative Westrom has moved your bill and has moved the 2199 amendment, and that's what the author wants to get it in the shape he wants to discuss it. Is that my understanding?
That's correct.
All in favor of the 2199 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Carried.
carries. Thank you. Representative Westrom, you had one word amendment?
Mr. Chair, I do. I just need to add an and if council could give it to us. Mr. Gehring's got it. And Representative Bly, I don't know if your heads up, there's an and missing in what we passed in the Energy Committee. And
Representative Bly?
Yes, I'm fine with that. Just so that members know, I think this is the Representative Westrom is referring to the amendment which he added to the bill. I think it begins on line 3.33, and I'm not sure exactly where you want the end, Representative Westrom, but perhaps
I'll let Mr. Gehring specify that.
Mr. Chair, the Representative Westrom, the amendment is on page 3, line 35, after highway, comma, insert and. That's just a grammatical correction.
It's already in there.
Okay, then we're covered. Okay.
So we don't have to worry about that.
No.
Okay, I'm sorry. Representative Bly, why don't you go ahead and we'll try to get this somehow done in 15 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Mallory.
For both sides.
Yes,
not
right,
for
right.
You.
I appreciate your hearing this bill. I'm hopeful that many of you are familiar with it. We did have an interim hearing on the bill, and also the bill came before the body as a whole last year as an amendment and did get a strong support. I should say that the history of the bill, initially I was asking for the public service corporation exemptions to be removed from all public service corporations. However, in order to move the bill forward, I did meet with representatives from the League of Minnesota Cities and others to address their concerns. I have also met with Xcel Energy and the cooperatives. We did not, however, find language that would work to resolve some of their concerns. Perhaps in a future date we can address that. But I do have three testifiers. I'd like to each say a few words about the bill, and then we could take questions, and others who wish to testify can
okay,
do so.
Fine. Because of the time, we'll try and not duplicate. Who's first, Ms. Backabee, or I'm sorry, I don't know you.
Yeah.
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paula Mackabee, and I don't do any work in condemnation, but I represent citizens who are affected by power lines. I represent citizens who are affected by several of the CapEx 2020 power lines and by also the Hiawatha Project. And this is not a partisan issue. I represent citizens who are Republicans, who are Democrats, sometimes neighbors, sometimes in the same household. And none of them oppose electricity, and most of them don't oppose transmission. They just want to be treated fairly when the electric utilities need to take their land in order to make sure that the power runs for all of us. And they want to make sure that the electric utilities choose a route that minimizes the impacts on homes and businesses. And often, as it's clear from Representative Westrom's amendment, by putting power lines on other utility corridors or on highway corridors, that is the way often to minimize impacts on homes and businesses, which is what we're all seeking. And based on the experiences of my clients, some of whom have are in the area affected by the Fargo power line and highway corridor was not considered, we believe that House File 1182 is a helpful bill, and that the Westrom Amendment, to the extent it can reduce impacts on homes and businesses, is also helpful. And people who do not choose to be dragged into the legal system, do not choose to have their property affected, now will be getting some protection to make sure that they're fairly treated and fairly compensated, and that's a very positive thing.
Next witness, state your name.
I just want to draw your attention. I do believe that in your packets you did receive a booklet from Mr. Sass, just to make sure that you're aware of that, and he may refer to that.
State your name.
Thank you. And good morning. My name is Rod Krass, K-R-A-S-S. I live in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I am an attorney who in the past 40 years has represented many people in condemnation actions, both government and private property owners.
Are you the Krass in Krass and Monroe?
I am. I don't know if that's considered good or bad. But
I was a consultant for one of the attorneys on an appellate court case against you.
Okay. The legislature in the year 2006 passed some badly needed amendments and changes to the eminent domain law, which really had remained unchanged for many, many decades. It approved in 2006 some changes that really helped property owners. Then it turned around and exempted those changes for private and public, but I'm more concerned about private utility companies, profit-making companies. I happen to represent 54 property owners in the recent Minnesota-Canadian oil line that Koch Industries built. It was a 300-mile line, went around the west side of the Twin Cities up to Rosemount to Koch Industries. And I've given you some information that I gleaned and took from those property owners and my experience directly. All of the information there is public record, because for each condemnation parcel, a order was issued by the condemnation commission appointed in that county and approved by the court. So I'm not giving you information that is not public. There were seven exemptions given to private utilities. The first was what I call the lowball penalty, the penalty against the propensity to make lowball offers to property owners. And the penalty is that if you have done this and the legislature has set up the mechanism to determine that, then you're going to pay some additional costs and fees, including some attorney's fees. And the mechanism the legislature set is if it's 20% to 40% more than the last offer given, if that's the result, you may be awarded this penalty. If it's over 40%, you will be awarded this penalty. Next door in Wisconsin, that percentage number is 15. That cuts down, a penalty like that cuts down the lowball offers. And why do utilities make them? Because they work. In the MNCAM process, there were 1,100 property owners who had property taken by MNCAM. 850 resolved their matter with the first offer, and consequently never had the advantage of any of these exemptions and never would have. If it costs Koch Industries, in my case, money to defend an effort to get a reasonable amount, they're well money ahead, or they wouldn't be doing these kinds of things. As you can see in the list I gave you, the percentages are set forth between the last offer and the resolution of the case. The largest percentage where a condemnation commission made the award, the largest percentage difference was over 800%. In the settlements, it was over 1,100%. So you can see where they start and where they finish. And all those folks who settled up front, you saw where they started. A second thing that was required of all other condemning authorities is a requirement for negotiations, that you sit down ahead of time, provide an appraisal to the property owner, give them an idea what you think their property is worth, and talk to them before you start the condemnation. Sounds like a very reasonable thing. It was your determination of what was necessary, except for private utilities, private profit-making utilities. The third requirement was a notice and 20 days public hearing for the property owners to challenge the public purpose of the project, if that is appropriate, and again, an exemption for the private utilities. You have provided that if the state, any county, any city, school district, HRA, anybody, any government with condemnation authority proceeds to take property and destroys a business, and you have a very strict requirement and bar for the determination of when that occurs, that destroyed business has to get paid for unless it gets destroyed by a private utility. The next exemption is compensation, a minimum amount of compensation to give somebody at least the amount to buy a replacement property exemption. Sixth one is that the condemning authority can't be forced to make the property owner accept some of the property back, and again, an exemption. And the last one is interesting because in the 1970s, the federal government passed a Uniform Relocation and Assistance Statute, a federal law, which most all states, including Minnesota, have always used as kind of the Bible for relocation. Again, there is, in fact, an exemption for relocation, those relocation benefits for private utilities.
Representative Bly, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up fairly quick. I think we should go to the other side and get their testimony and then maybe have a couple questions. I believe there's opposition at least. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I'll be very brief. I'd like to address just one of the concerns that we have with House File 1182. As you know, back in 2007, the United States Supreme Court, maybe it was 2006, decided the Kelo case, which permitted cities to condemn property of a private landowner, convey that property to another private landowner for development, and the increased tax value of the property was deemed by the court to be a sufficient public purpose to justify the taking. It was a very controversial decision, and in response to it, many states, including Minnesota, adopted new limits and conditions on condemnations, as Mr. Crass was just describing. At the time, in Minnesota, the public utility companies asked to be exempt from those new laws. The reason was that for the exemption was that utilities, when they use eminent domain, the public purpose for their project has already been established in a long process before the Public Utilities Commission, and in addition, the taking is limited to that public purpose. In addition, the nature of utilities' use of eminent domain is ordinarily the acquisition of an easement rather than taking the fee interest in the property, which raises different issues from the kinds of taking addressed in the Kelo decision. And that was the reason that we asked to be exempt from those provisions, which were addressed to a very specific problem at the time. Since that time, utilities have increased their construction of transmission lines across Minnesota, and that increased activity has brought this issue back before the legislature this year. Utilities have continued to assert that their use of eminent domain is significantly different from other takings and therefore should have different treatment under the law. But at the same time, we've come to understand that there's a strong feeling in the legislature that the laws must be made uniform to assure equal treatment for all the parties. Consequently, I'd like to just address two issues very quickly that cause us some concern. Under House File 1182, utilities would be covered by the statute that Mr. Crass referred to, where legal fees could be awarded if the final award by the court was higher than the last written offer by the utilities. In all the other areas of civil law that I'm familiar with, we have a tradition that's reflected in our statutes and laws that attorney's fees are not awarded unless one of the parties has engaged in some kind of misconduct, either bringing a frivolous claim or somehow acting in bad faith. We believe that rule should apply in condemnation cases. Particularly, the 40% rule assigns an arbitrary point at which attorney's fees are awarded without any consideration of whether of the conduct of the parties. Parties will have honest and good faith differences of opinion about the value of property, and particularly in issues involving easements, which can be more subjective than outright purchases of property. Condemnation cases often turn on the opinion evidence of appraisers, and clearly opinions can differ widely on the value of property or the loss of value associated with an easement. We believe that a utility should not be required to pay attorney's fees for property owners if the utility has bargained in good faith and has a sound basis for the offer it makes, and we wish that the law would reflect that standard. Even if ultimately the court decides to award a higher amount, we believe it's not fair to penalize a utility when it's shown that the utility has done nothing wrong. The only other issue that I would mention just very briefly is the amendment at the end of the bill, which has to do with the priority for routing power lines. Currently, Minnesota has a statute, Section 216E.03, that lays out some fairly detailed standards for routing power lines. We don't have any objection to this particular language that's here, but we think it is going to be confusing to have a provision in 117 and then other provisions in 216E. I think Chair Hilty has a bill which hopefully is going to bring these two together in the proper section, but I raise it here just as a concern that we should try to keep our prioritization of routing in one section of the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, then, whose motion? Representative Western, he's no longer here. Well, somebody, I'll Representative Druskowski will, Representative Druskowski, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask, maybe for clarification, what this bill would do is put public service corporations in exactly the same category as local units of government when they take land. Is that correct?
Or the state or counties, correct. All units of government.
So they'd be perfectly on par.
Yes.
Mr. Kraft.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Evans, did you want to weigh in on that quickly?
Sorry.
Yeah, very, very quickly. I think it's worth pointing out, Minnesota utilities for many years have had a provision in statute that we loosely call by the farm that applies only to utilities and not to anyone else. So there are special provisions. That provision says if we're purchasing an easement across someone's land and they decide they want to make us buy the entire piece of property rather than live with the easement, we're required to purchase the entire piece of property. So it may not be relevant to this, but it is important to know that utilities do bear extra burdens under the law in addition to some of the benefits that some people think we may have gotten.
Okay, thank you. We're quite a bit over, so let's see. Representative Truskowski will renew the original Westrom motion to pass, and it goes to the pass as amended and goes to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.